produce a very high gain vertical antenna. Of course, that wouldn't work, but that was the whole point of it. It was basically a carbon cylinder, hollow cylinder with a core with a line slit down the side.
Mine was that an antenna mounted above ground will reflect, and if you have sensitive and accurate enough equipment, it often looks like there's a signal coming from underground below the antenna. So this proposed burying the antenna used an effective resource.
Okay, it's as good as anything. A couple of years ago, someone did an article that they basically decided to do a joke on a J-pole, and they decided to kind of reorient the copper pipes, and because it looked like a Q, they called it a Q-pole. It didn't electronically work, but it was very funny to see.
If it was, it's not an April Fool's article.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've read more than a few weird antenna articles where I checked the calendar to make sure it wasn't April edition.
But you haven't done a puzzle in a very long time.
In the early days, they let you figure it out, and I felt I was totally, totally wrong. Somewhere, they had to tell you April Fool's.
Usually they gave you hints, but they didn't just kind of basically say it. Like this particular hoax, I think they said the original inventor or something like that was if you spelled April Fool's backwards. So, you know, it was a good hint.
Roy, if you're hearing me, you suddenly disappeared. You fell off a cliff. Roy, I don't know if it's
you
or you, but you fell off a cliff. I
think
it came back.
He's on All-Star tonight. He probably got kicked off. Give him a minute.
Understand.
Hello, AC2GS. I got thrown off of All-Star again. If I missed what you said, Ed, please repeat it.
No, I was telling you, it disappeared. Just fell off the cliff. It wasn't a terrible relevant point. It was just finishing up.
Yeah, that's what happened. Anyway, but I was trying to say that this guy, when we interviewed him, he said there were a couple of engineers who contacted him through email that wanted more specifications for the make-believe antenna.
See my point exactly? If it's a technical magazine, you can't get away with that. You have to say, this is a lie.
I don't know. I'm just used to it. It's that they've been doing it for so many damn years. I mean, like I said, I'm not being facetious. If I read an article on a very esoteric, dubious antenna, and there's more than a few of them out there, I double-check the date issue of the magazine to make sure. Because there were other magazines back in the days when there were a lot of magazines. There were other magazines that used to pull this nonsense. And I agree with you. I don't think the ARRL considers QSC to be a proper technical periodical. You know, they have a quarterly that serves that purpose. So I think that, you know, they tend to give in to their kind of jocular energies.
I think you underestimate QSC. But never mind me. This may be before you. No, this isn't real time. NBVM, Narrowband Voice Message Modulation, was the biggest thing for about a year or two. That quietly disappeared. It wasn't April Fool's article, but it didn't work.
I mean, you know, there were articles in other popular magazines, not technical ones, that were full of baloney. I mean, I still remember back in the 60s, one of the biggest hoaxes that smacked me was something that was very popular in popular science. It was called polywater.
Wait a minute. I didn't have polywater. When I was attending the Polytechnic Institute, I drank hydrogen from water. That's
polywater. Yeah, well, I mean, this was supposed to be polymerized water. What it was I think it was a Russian lab didn't clean their glassware.
In Russia, they never cleaned their glassware.
I can believe that.
TGASS.
Okay.
No, I read this somewhere. I did not experiment with this firsthand. I've read this. In Russia, it is common to find a street vendor selling this particular beverage for spots. And everybody uses the same glass. There's one glass.
Okay.
That's it. There is no punchline. You can stretch it out.
Okay, well, let's see if, I hope Sam is still around because we're going to be running out of time soon. Sam, are you still out there? Yeah, I was concerned that we might have lost Sam. You know, it took this long. Well, we got a couple of minutes. Anyone with any comments before we move on to the next segment?
Kilo Delta 2, Mike India.
You doubled. Kilo Delta 2?
Good evening, Roy. Name's John. Kilo Delta 2, Mike India. Getting back to, it was a ham that asked about propagation software. I found a website that's pretty good that would do what he was asking, whether, you know, you can put in different types of antennas, put in a grid square, put in different powers, levels, and you it'll predict with a certain degree of accuracy the path. I can give you the website now.
Sure.
Okay, it's voacap.com/HF. So that's Victor Ocean Alpha, Charlie Alpha Papa, .com/ Hotel Foxtrot.
Okay, very good. Maybe I'll put it up on my link page during the SpaceNet.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to add that. 73.
KG2RY.
73, and thank you very much. Yes, David?
I have a question. You have a guitar, with a guitar, and the frets are removed, so you can go in between the notes, quarter tone and half tone. What do you know about this?
Not much. I never really played the guitar. I played the trumpet, but never the guitar. So, yeah, I would imagine that it kind of opens you up to a whole different non-standard notes. You know, they're still out there just because no one uses them or very few people use them. And occasionally people with experimental music kind of try all kinds of things. You know, it's rather an infinite spectral sound range. We kind of limit them in octaves because it sounds nicer to our ears.
Thank you, Roy. This is KG2RY.
Knowing nothing about that specific question, I haven't thought.
Sure, Ed.
Music has been around as long as civilization. And people have been playing music as long as there are people. And I think that the way we do it now, the standard way, developed over the years as the best way. And maybe in this case, we're better off not messing with it.
Well, okay, let's see if I'm back. I got thrown off again, Ed. Probably, but you know, I mean, I think in Asia, they have some music that has atonal cues that are a little bit weird to our ears. They still use octaves, as far as I'm aware, like we do, but they have other tones that they use. So, you know, I mean, who knows? I think it's a cultural, historical thing of what instruments were introduced in different societies and what languages people speak. European languages don't really have tonal cues, per se, whereas Asian languages, very often, you can say what seems to be the same word with a slightly different intonation and completely change the meaning of what you're saying.
And what if, how to say, I can't think of what I wanted to ask.
Oh, well, it happens to everyone, David.
Maybe if you're listening to acoustic instruments like a jazz band, you know, with an acoustic stand-up bass and a real piano, you know, the feelings that you get from acoustic instruments, quite a phenomenon, I think, compared to listening to recorded music on a stereo.
Yeah, ultimately it kind of depends on people, the quality of their hearing. There are unfortunately tone-deaf people out there who can't tell the difference between almost anything. You could make the worst MP3 in creation and have them listen to it, and they say it's fine by them. So it depends upon a lot of factors, and you're never quite sure. Some of these audiophiles, you're never quite sure if they're being honest with everyone or just kind of grifting. You know, it's kind of like the same thing with wine experts. You know, I'm sure some of them know what they're talking about, but every so often I'm sure there's a guy who's just kind of making this stuff up.
Well, on YouTube, the quality of some of these videos, the audio in them, is quite adequate. It's not too bad. There's this one video, this guy.
David, you fell right out of the repeater. David, you fell out of the repeater.
The sound that creates the health and well-being.
David, you're falling out of the repeater, unfortunately. I don't know what happened, but maybe your battery's low. Well, David, I don't know, you're kind of falling in and out of the repeater, so it's kind of difficult to follow you, but it's already 10:20, so I want to thank you, David, and everyone else who participated tonight. I hope you enjoyed yourselves, I hope you learned a few things, and hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. So we'll talk more about this next week, David, okay?
Thank you, Roy, KG2RY.
Okie doke. Well, it's 10:20 plus, so time for the SpaceNet report. Paul WS2N.
AC2GSWS2N. SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, good topic tonight. And I like Jim's mirror story for propagation changes. That was pretty good. National Atmospheric and Ocean Administration, NOAA, launched a rocket a couple of days ago, and they used the SpaceX Falcon 9 to do it, and they had three different spacecraft on board that are going to investigate the sun, but the one that I was interested in is called the IMAP, Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe. It got off the ground successfully and deorbited Earth, and the reason for that is going to fly to roughly a million miles away from the Earth, actually 93 million miles away from the Earth. And it will park itself into the Lagrange Point 1 location and just sit there and look at the sun. And as we go around the Earth, 365 days it takes to go around, it will take the IMAP the same amount of time to do the same thing. And because it's at a gravitational point, L1, it uses very, very little fuel to keep it at location, because it's a balancing point between the sun and the Earth. It's in between. The sun is trying to pull it. The Earth is keeping it from going in, and then also the acceleration, the 66,000 miles per hour as it's going around the sun, keeps it, between all those factors, keeps it at that location. So there's been other spacecraft that have been put there before: Discover, ACE, SOHO. Paul? Yeah, I heard Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard about L1. If I remember right, and it's very possible I don't, the first comet was a million miles away. And that sounds about right, but you also said 93 million miles away, which, as you know, is the distance to the sun. Was that just a, but you said a million and 93 million, and I think 1 million is pretty close to right.
Is that the way it came out? Yeah, of course. We're 93 million miles away, and this is 1 million miles away from us. So I guess it's, 92 million miles away from the sun. Anyway, that's Lagrange Point 1. And this particular probe is going to be looking at the heliosphere. Heliosphere actually doesn't just cover the area around the sun and the Earth. It covers the entire solar system. So they're looking to study that more. They're looking to study all the different interactions between what's coming toward us from outside the solar system, and what the sun is producing to keep this heliosphere in place. And they have different instruments on board this thing. There's roughly about 10 different types of instruments on board IMAP. And they're going to measure everything from actual neutral atoms that leave the sun, helium and hydrogen, oxygen, any actual atoms that move, away from the sun. There's a detector for that. And then there's a detector for, all your ions that move away from the sun. And the combination of different ones, and now that data is going to go into the spacecraft. IMAP will have all 10 detectors facing the sun, the other side of the IMAP spacecraft is pointing toward the Earth. Now, this is a little over 2,000-pound spacecraft, so it's on the heavy side. It's not too huge, but it's going to be transmitted on a K-band back to Earth constantly. They say the amount of data that's coming back is going to be tremendous. You know, terabytes of data by the time they're done. They're planning for a 3-year mission, but they're expecting to get like a 5-year mission out of it. And sometimes these things go much longer, you know, whatever they can get out of it. And IMAP will take a couple of months to actually get to that location. So, you know, it's not like they put enough fuel on board to, you know, zoom out to the L1 location and then jam the brakes on, you know, put enough fuel and rockets to slow it down to wind up in that location. What they do is they know exactly how much fuel to put in. They just launch it from the Earth, and it's constantly slowing down. And they know how long it's going to take before it slows down enough to wind up in that location. And it's going to take a couple of months before it actually gets there. But once it's there, it'll go into complete operation, and it'll join the other spacecraft that are out there. Like I said, SOHO is still out there, and ACE is still there, and Discover. Discover is the one that they sent years ago. Originally was called Triana. And Triana was supposed to go back in, the turn of the century. And that didn't happen because they had a different administration and decided that they didn't want to know about the sun. They didn't care about climate, global warming or anything. So they canceled that and put Triana in warp for many years until the administration changed and said, let's bring this thing back to life. And they did. It was many years later, and they brought it back under a new name called Discover, and they added a couple of instruments. And anyway, that thing's been out there, very successful. That's the one that actually has cameras on board that looks back at Earth. You could see Earth 24 hours a day if you wanted to. Great pictures. You could see the moon, going around the Earth. That's Discover. This one doesn't have any regular cameras. This one has all kinds of instruments on board. So IMAP is on the way, and I've been following that one. Any comments?
I just saw a question, Paul.
SAWB3AP. You remember the Paul Sagan Tell Blue Dot speech and photograph? I'm wondering, if you tried to repeat that, how would the Earth look from that vantage point?
Carl Sagan, yeah, the Pale Blue Dot. In fact, I have that book. Yeah, and what was it, toward the, in the 90s, I guess 92 or so, 93, he took Voyager 1 and pointed it back toward Earth and took a picture. And I took a lot of pictures. He took the whole field. He got the different planets and a bunch of pictures, and then he spliced all the pictures together. And one of the pictures showed Earth as a very small blue dot. Hence the name. And that was decades ago. But if you were to do that now, with a different spacecraft, there's nothing right now except maybe, I don't know how to, let's see, there's a New Horizon. I mean, but that's gone way past Pluto now. So, I guess if that thing looked back and took a picture, I don't know if you would pick up the Earth. But yeah, really, what's your question? Try that again, Ed.
I'm just saying, compared to that, how is the Earth look from 1 billion miles away? Or will it actually be able to resolve something if it's just their thought?
No, there's many pictures from Discover. And Discover, it's how do they spell it? D-S-C-O-V-E-R. They leave out a letter because it stands for something. I forget what the acronym is. But, you know, it's really, if you put Discover satellite into Google, you're going to, you know, see all about the satellite. And then you can have pictures. In fact, it's still operating, so, you know, I guess you can go to their website and see what the latest pictures are. And the idea of it was to actually look at Earth. And you can see the whole Earth. And you know, you take a picture, you don't need multiple pictures. The Earth, the whole Earth shows up. And, you know, you take multiple pictures and you can see the Earth rotating. You can see the cloud cover and all. And that was the idea to give scientists and the public, you know, the view of what Earth looked like with all the clouds. And so, yeah, it comes out great. And then you can see the moon sometimes moving in front of the Earth, you know, between the satellite and the Earth. And it's quite clear. You know, great pictures. So you can see the continents and all, no problem. Back to you, Ed.
Yeah, now that I think about it, you know, the moon is a quarter of that distance, and it's about a quarter of the size of the Earth. So I would say that, you know, if it was somehow being transported up there and looking at the Earth from that point, it would kind of look like the moon does now from Earth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's times the distance away of the moon. So, yeah. A lot of people have asked, you know, well, I already answered the question, but a lot of people have asked, if the moon is, you know, a quarter of a million miles away, and it only took the astronauts, you know, that went to the moon, you know, 3.5 days to get there and then orbit it and then land. It took 3.5 days. How come it takes 2 months to get all the way to the 1 million mile location, you know, which is four times the distance? You know, shouldn't it take, you know, 12 days? But it doesn't work that way. Again, it's like throwing a ball up in the air. And the ball just slows down. Eventually, the ball winds up getting down to zero. You know, even if you throw 50 feet in the air, it gets down to zero speed, and then starts coming back down. And that's what they do with these satellites. Actually, they do that all the time. You know, it's a way of saving fuel. You know, you don't have to lift a heavier payload of fuel. If you could throw a spacecraft in the direction and just wind up having it stop, you know, by the time, you know, it loses its velocity, it happens to be, winds up in that gravitational well between, you know, between the Earth and Sun, you're good to go. And there's, of course, that's the L1, and there's L2, that's the other direction of the moon, you know, well, you know, you would have Sun, Earth, and then four times the distance of the moon in the other direction. That's where you wind up with your other satellites, like, you know, James Webb Space Telescope. Back to you, Ed.
You referenced the Apollo mission at the time, but there they had a reason to rush. The people on board, they weren't sure about the effects of cosmic rays. They had to pack all kinds of food and supplies. They had to get rid of bodily waste. I mean, there had to be a lot of people on board. The people needed stuff that a box of instruments doesn't need. And I think that's why they rushed. And another point, the Apollo program, the idea is they went into orbit around the moon. I don't think you have any... I think L1 is a totally arcane mathematically derived reference point with nothing substantial to it. And so that might make stopping a problem. It might use a lot of precious fuel. Going faster uses a lot more fuel. If you're in no rush, you can save a lot of fuel. There are games you can play. But we've waited how long for this box of instruments to be launched? As far as anybody sitting on it. So what's the rush? If we do it a certain way, we can save a tremendous amount of money and hassle with complexities as extra weight, extra fuel burn. That's my thing.
Yeah, they were always playing space pinball, you know, with all these gravitational fields. Japanese sent one. They wanted to orbit the moon. They sent it out to around 800,000 miles out, close to 1,000,000 miles out. And then by doing that, eventually it started to come back toward Earth. And they figured out where the moon was going to be at a certain time. And by the time it got into near the moon, it was easier for them, or a lot less fuel. It was moving much slower when it came back toward the moon to fire the retro rockets and put it into orbit instead of just, you know, heading directly to the moon and slowing down that way. Yeah, with all the flights to the moon, they had to worry about consumables, oxygen, food, water. Like you said, space radiation, you know, let's keep the guys up there as little time as possible. So that's what they did, you know. And they had a big enough rocket, you know, with the final stage to slow them down. You know, they were moving pretty fast when they picked up the speed when they got near the moon. The gravitational pull accelerated them. You know, they launched from Earth at 25,000 miles per hour. Normal orbital speed is 17,500 miles an hour. To get out of that Earth gravitational well, they have to go a lot faster, up to 25,000 miles an hour to escape Earth gravity. And then, you know, sure enough, they keep slowing down. I think they get down to, I don't know, 6,000 or 8,000 miles an hour. They just keep getting slower until they get to the point where they get into the influence of the gravitational field of the moon. The moon starts pulling them. Next thing you know, they start accelerating faster, and they're up to, like, they go up from, I think they slow down to 4, and then by the time you get into orbit around the moon, it's like 6,000. But moving pretty good, you know, if they don't slow down when they get to the moon, they're not going to get into orbit. So then they fire the S-4B engine, and that's just what they do. And that whole setup stayed in lunar orbit for the whole trip by the LEM down to the moon and then back up again. Again, they needed enough fuel to accelerate out of the gravity well of the moon and head back to Earth. Yeah, big difference between that and trying to set something out at the L1 or the L2 position. James Webb Space Telescope, when it went to the L2 position, took, I think, what was it, about a month, maybe 6 weeks or so before it got out to L2. So they had all that time to do all this origami and setting everything up. It was all, you know, collapsed inside of the Ariane 5 rocket when it took off, and it all had to be expanded. The sun shield is as big as a tennis court, and that some kind of very complicated, you know, hundreds of moves that had to be made to open up the 21-foot diameter mirror. And that was all very complex. They had plenty of time, like you said, and, you know, it's a thing. They didn't have to worry about people on board.
KG2R1.
KG2RY. Hi, Dave. You sound good now.
Thank you very much. I'm using an RF signal with a vertical antenna. You know, I have another question. It's nothing to do with the moon. Should I ask it now, or should I wait until you're on the topic?
No, that's okay. You can ask it now. You know, I don't have as many topics as I normally do. You know, with the change of the, you know, they no longer have a permanent NASA administrator, or full-time, let me put it that way, a full-time administrator. So they've really cut back on, from what I see, information. I used to get, you know, I used to go to the NASA website and get tons of information. Now I get, yeah, I still get information, but it seems like the details, you know, are far and few between. So I'm not getting, you know, there's just not as many topics. There's plenty of upcoming missions I could talk about, but yeah, I'd rather have you ask a question. Back to you, Dave.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'll ask this question. I was reading that China had launched satellites for communication. 10 gigabit per second internet. Signal was a laser, not RF, and quite successful for that. What do you know about this?
Yeah, China's trying to develop that as well. We're ahead of them, you know. I've talked about that before. Different experiments we've done. We've had satellite in geosynchronous orbit that they've tested and sent up signals to and from that. They made a transmission from the International Space Station with a laser up to that satellite and then back down again. Quite a few years ago they did that. Then they sent another spacecraft. It wasn't its main purpose, it had other purposes, but on board it had a laser transmitter that is in orbit around the moon, and that thing sent back a transmission. They picked it up. We had special receivers to pick up the laser here on Earth, and that was some kind of a picture that they sent back. What they did is that before they launched it, they had. Well, they had pictures put into this thing. I think it was a picture of a cat or something at a JPL. But anyway, that came back, you know, perfectly readable. And now on another spacecraft called Psyche. What is it, Psyche? Yeah, let me drop it. Psyche has a transmitter attached to it. And a receiver, and that thing was, well, eventually it's going to go to the asteroid belt, so I think it was getting close to Mars, and they ran a test, and what happened was the JPL sent the signal up on a laser, and
the spacecraft was able to orient itself, and by picking up that signal, it knew exactly, you know, what angle and everything that it should be pointing to communicate with Earth. At that point, it transmitted its own signal. I think it only had, believe it or not, it was like a 4-watt transmitter on the laser. And it transmitted all the way back, you know, like 100 million miles, across, something like that, across space. And it was picked up by the receiving station. And that worked, which is very important because they're going to, it's like you said, what was this, a giga, 10 giga per second, you said. Well, you know, we probably did the same thing or better. And you're going to need these high bandwidth and high bit rate to be able to communicate on a regular basis. You know, once you have a bunch of people sitting around on Mars, RF is just not going to cut it. I mean, RF will work, but, you know, you want to be able to send maybe 100 times the amount of data back than you can with RF. And laser is the way to go. So we've been experimenting with it. We're on our way to having a regular setup. Let me drop it.
Of course, WB-380.
Okay, yeah, well, I just want to say that there are plans now to put satellites into geosynchronous orbit for regular communications using the laser system. And instead of the TDRS system, the tracking data relay system, which we have now, which has been around for decades. Ed, back to you.
Acid lasers and RF have an awful lot in common. It's just a different frequency. The fact that laser is in theory visible and RF isn't, it's just almost like a collateral damage as well as it's a side effect. But here's the point of the laser beams tend to be far narrower than it takes a huge antenna. Yeah, a very, very narrow antenna beam. But when you're dealing with space, you want to focus the energy go back to Earth, hit the Earth. And there's only so much you can narrow the beam down so you're missing the Earth. With a laser, not only has higher bandwidth in the hardware that you make a transmitter, higher bandwidth than you can for RF, plus the hardware limitations, but you also have to aim it extremely carefully going up to make sure the signal covers the satellite and doesn't miss entirely. And that means lasers require, well, both of them require very, very precise tracking. You have to keep the target, the Earth or the satellite, within the width of a very narrow beam. So you have to point the beam very, very, very precisely. And the narrower the beam, i.e. laser, the more complicated the tracking system has to be. That's it.
Yeah, and that's why they had the, like on the Psyche mission, when it was 100 million miles away, they transmit first from Earth with a powerful laser, and the Psyche spacecraft was able to pick that up. And once it picked it up, it knew exactly how to orient itself to make the to make their transmitter. It was only a 4-watt laser transmitting back, and that's what they did. So I thought that was very well done. They have a couple of these locations around the country setting themselves up for a lot more of this. You know, the Chinese I'm sure, you know, that they're going to come along too, you know. They, you know, maybe they stole our plans or something. but I know we're ahead of them when it comes to this. But, you know, don't look back because somebody's chasing you. I want to go back to Dave because he brought this up. Dave, over to you.
KG2RY, how do you set up 10 gigabit Ethernet, 10 gigabit internet in your house? First of all, your computer has to be capable of at least 10 gigabit, and you have to put on top of your house, and you have to run a wire down, or maybe fiber optic cable.
Dave, you faded out again, but I have an answer for you. If you have the money that they spend on a spacecraft, you can do that too.
Yeah, but you realize that 10 gigabit per second is a reality. Even though I'm happy with 500 megabit, and if you want to buy a Starlink, you can put a dish on your roof, run a wire down, and you'll get a 250 megabit per second.
It's back down to, was it 10 gigabits or 10, what did you say? The difference between bits and bytes. But anyway, it's not like they're going to be transmitting to individual homes or cell phones or anything. They'll probably use that for, let's say some of their satellites. You know, they have spacecraft all over the solar system too. So maybe they'll use that for transmitting to the using it as a relay, and then the laser will transmit back down to China directly to like a gateway, and then they'll pick up that data from there. It's not like the individual user is going to have a 10 gigabyte system to decode this. They would never have that anyway. Lasers will never be used for mobile communications for the average person. A cloud goes by and that's it, you know. You have bad weather and that's it, all stop, you know. Then they have to go to Plan B, which is RF. Back to you, Dave.
QSO. Well, I get pretty good performance with the Verizon Fios, 500 megabit per second, fiber optic connection, pretty stable, more stable than my other one. And to say, you know, I'm very pleased with it, and there are other options you can have. One is Starlink. You can have Starlink, 250 megabit per second, satellite-enabled internet. And what else? I guess there's probably a lot of choices now.
Wait. Fios is the laser is going right into a glass fiber that is about the size of a 40-inch piece of wire. They have a very narrow beamlet going to a very narrow target. Falling is very, very, very different. It's RF. The field spreads out tremendously. It's going out to space. And you have to take all of that into account.
Yeah. But Starlink, I haven't tried it. I've only read about it and looked into it, you know. And like, how to say that there might be problems with clouds and weather and things like that.
KE2GOG.
KE2GOG, go ahead. Name is Paul, WS2N.
Hi, Paul. This is Alfonso. I was wondering, well, listening, obviously, this whole time, but I was wondering, what about Starlink? Can they turn and point their transmission to spacecraft and relay to the Earth?
Well, I thought you're talking about their optics, connections between one satellite and another. Are you saying they to take that and point that to the Earth?
No, point it to other spacecraft. Yes, you know, transmit, you know, from the Earth to their current satellite system, and then their current satellite system points out to outer space, control and communicate other spacecraft and satellites.
I don't remember what system that they had. I know there's connections between some of the satellites. They were originally RF, and then I don't know if they went with the laser. I know the Kuiper system by Jeff Bezos, the Amazon project. We're going to have 3,200 satellites up there. Those things are supposed to have all that capability. I would imagine that SpaceX, I'll have to read about this system. I really don't know. But, you know, they do have to do this. They have to have that, you know, when they're over the U.S., somebody transmits up, and they want to talk to England. You know, those satellites have to transmit from one to the other. And I really don't know. I think they have to be using RF. I don't think they switch to lasers. Maybe the newer version, you know, they have different versions of installing satellites. There was version 1, 2, and from what I understand, they're going to have version 3 once the Starship system is operational. But back to you. Good question. Okay, stand by 1 second, Ed. Let me turn it back to him. We're starting to get late anyway. I don't want to lose him. Back to you. KE2GOG.
That time complete.
Yes, Alfonso. No, I figured that they would be all over it. And the other question, you know, I want to throw at you guys because it dawned on me. As the laser travels through space, how much spread does it have in, say, the application that was used? How much was the actual spread around the spacecraft at that point?
Well, the one that was transmitted up, I don't remember that one, but I know the one that was the 4-watt one transmitted down, I think was, you know, couple hundred feet or something by the time it got down to the Earth, which was pretty good. You know, I mean, it sounds like it's too wide, but it was good enough for them to pick up. And then the photo detecting system is so sensitive on Earth, they were able to pick up the photons that they were able to pick up. You know, it's not like a sharp laser coming all the way through space. It does open up. That's the big difference between, like Ed was talking about earlier, you know, it's very similar, like the same thing, you know, laser and RF. Yeah, but the receiving, the way they receive it is different. You know, you're receiving, you know, photons. You're feeling, you know, you've got a receiver that's not picking up, you know, the waves that the same RF waves that you transmit on, you know, on 10 gigahertz, you know, what you're picking up is, you know, actual photons, and the charge couple devices are taking that, and then they're converting it to data, you know. So, you know, it's there's a difference, you know.
just looking at the time. Ed wanted to make a statement. Let me go back to Ed before it gets any later. We're supposed to turn it back to Roy at 11. Back to you, Ed.
I'm Razor Swift. There's two things to say about. First of all, lasers, the magic, to use the term, is all in the transmitter side. You have to have coherent light. The coherence is what makes it be narrow. And I believe the coherence is not necessary for carrying the data or reception. So the receiver isn't that big a deal. I mean, of course, it's totally different than receiving RF. But here's the point. When you talk about these long distances, everything is the width of the beam. Whatever the beam is, if the beam is too wide, you're missing your intended target. If the beam is too narrow, you're then missing your intended target because but you may want to hit point A and point B. They both have to be in the beam at the same time. And then when pointing depends on a complicated control system that's bidirectional. It gets really complicated very quick. Okay, Paul.
Okay, I haven't read about the system in a couple of months, but since I guess it's probably, time gets away. I guess about 6 months, 8 months ago, they did they did one of the tests. I guess the end of last year, maybe. That's what Psyche, you put in the Psyche spacecraft laser experiment, and that will come up. And it's really fascinating. They show the building. I think they had a building they set up in California. And another building in New Mexico. One of them was sending up the laser going up to Psyche spacecraft, 100 million miles away, and the other one was in the receiving location. One was transmitting, hundreds of miles away, and the receiver was in a different location. But it all worked, and they're happy with that, and that's why they're now in the production of actual new TDRS satellites using optics as one of the main transmitters. You know, TDRS they have like 11 TDRS satellites in geosynchronous orbit working right now. You know, so the Hubble or the ISS wants to transmit, TV data or anything, they would transmit up to the geosynchronous satellites, the TDRS, and TDRS transmits them back down to different gateways on Earth. That's how that's all done. Imagine that being replaced by not 100% laser, but like I said, once there's clouds in there, that won't work. They'll always have to have the backup. Anyway, looking at the time, let me close this portion of the net. If anybody wanted to say one last thing, I'll let them go before we turn it over to Roy.
K2GOG, Alfonso. Well, RF, you can bounce. Laser is line of sight, correct?
RF, you can bounce, you said? Is that what you said? Relay back, up to the station and back down. Both of them, they can, right?
A polished steel mirror will reflect both beautifully.
I meant to bounce off another planet.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Possible.
Got a polished steel mirror. It wouldn't care if it was looking at RF or light. Very good. Anyway, thank everybody that joined this portion of the net, TechNet. And this has been WS2N Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Tomorrow night we have the ClubNet. You don't even have to be a member. You can join and you just get on these frequencies at 8:30. Check into